for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Robert Massey has turned his attention once again to Russia. In a new biography, he details the unlikely story of a young German princess who reigned as Empress of Russia for more than three decades in the late 18th century. His new book is titled Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. Robert Massey joins me in the studio, and of course, we'll be happy to have your calls. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to see you again.
Good morning. May I call you Diane?
Please call me Diane. Catherine was not originally her name.
No. Her name was Sophia. She was a very minor, very obscure German princess born in the Baltic port of Stettin. Her mother and father were both Germans. She was raised as a child in Germany, and she went to Russia at the age of 14 and never left. She never crossed the frontier, the Russian frontier, again after she arrived.
He should say she was born in 1729.
I should say that, yes.
But she dreamed of becoming a queen.
She was very ambitious. She was a very bright young girl. She had arguments with her tutors about really intellectual subjects, theological and so forth, when she was a very young girl. She was ambitious because she saw that her father, who was a general in the army of Frederick the Great, and her mother was a very young woman when Sophia was born, she was only 16, was interested in society and clothing and so forth. And her child was not. She was interested in larger things.
Ideas.
Ideas. She also wanted, to get away from her mother, and she, as I think some young women may still do, wanted to marry early in order to do that. But she was fueled all her life by this ambition. I can be more than what I am if I persevere, devote myself, and stand up to and clear the obstacles.
I love the fact that the book is subtitled Portrait of a Woman, because with the encyclopedic version of who Catherine the Great was, you have the surface. You don't have the heart of the woman. And that's what you've given us here. Tell us what documents you were relying on.
Well, I would say you're absolutely right. I was fascinated by the woman, the side of Catherine's life and work. Maybe it's because four of my six children are daughters, and I watched them grow up and learn what it is to become a woman. That was a part of it. The primary documents I use, certainly in the first half of the book, which take her up to the time she became empress, were her memoirs and her letters. Her memoirs were written after she became empress to explain to her son and grandson the sequence of her life and some of the decisions she'd made and why she made them. And they are extraordinarily honest for a royal person, then or now, anytime. And they gave me as a biographer, a sense of being somebody who to whom she was talking. She explained, this happened and then this happened.
Yeah.
She describes episodes in her life, meetings with people, difficulties with people. So, first of all, the memoirs. Secondly, her letters. Her letters to Voltaire, the great sort of guru of the Enlightenment, who was, of course, much, much older, but loved the fact that here, once she achieved the throne, that here was an empress who was willing to follow and try to put into practice his advice about benevolent despotism and so forth. And then I used in the book a number of her letters to primarily to Potemkin, the most famous of her lovers, perhaps her husband. There may have been a secret marriage, but the passion of those letters, if I can use a cliche, almost scorches the page. And she was very sincere. They had a tempestuous relationship for several years. Then Potemkin was a great man himself. He was devoted to her, but he was a man. And he couldn't understand why she wasn't always available in every sense to him. She said, but I have an empire to rule. And so eventually they had to part. And that was tempestuous. But they remained friends. She continued to rely on him. He was a giant figure, not only in her life, but in Russian history.
Take us back to the moment at which it was decided she would marry Peter III, who was indeed Peter the Great's grandson.
That was decided by the Empress Elizabeth, Peter the Great's daughter, who was the ruling empress, and although she had many lovers, never could conceive a child, never married, and never conceived a child. So she had no heir. So Elizabeth brought back her nephew, Peter, to Russia. He'd been born in Germany because his mother, Peter the Great's other daughter, had married a German prince. So Peter, who became Peter III, was brought back, made heir to the throne, and then Elizabeth needed a wife to produce a baby to assure the dynasty. And it happened that Catherine's mother was connected, even though very minor nobility, to Elizabeth through a love affair of Elizabeth. So Elizabeth imported Catherine to Russia at the age of 14, had her convert to Orthodoxy.
When she was a Lutheran.
That's right. When she converted, she became a Grand Duchess. And 2 years later, she married Peter.
At age 16.
She was 16, he was 17. But then there was a problem with Peter. He was afflicted with various psychological and physical ailments. He was not interested in Catherine, who was his second cousin. He was not interested in her sexually, which is not to say that he was not interested in other women as his life went along. But the incredible thing to me was that Catherine, this young woman in a foreign country, had to lie in bed next to this man for 9 years, and he never touched her. And finally, the empress, who was desperate, I mean, Catherine had been brought for a purpose, said, well, my dear, I notice you are friendly with these two men, Soltikov and Naryshkin. Which do you prefer? And she not only advocated but demanded that Catherine produce a child, and Catherine did. Her son Paul, who later became emperor.
And it was the Empress Elizabeth who took control of that child, so that Catherine really had no relationship with her own son.
That is part of Catherine's story and part of the accounting for what happened. Not only, Diane, did she take control, she came into the room where Catherine was lying on a birthing pad on the floor and took the baby. She was ecstatic, but she literally took the baby or handed it to a nurse and disappeared. And for the next 8 months, Catherine, the new mother, only saw her little son three times briefly. So their relationship was flawed from the beginning.
And never to be
It never really became a happy relationship.
Robert Massey, his new biography is titled Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. We'll take your calls, your questions. Join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. And welcome back. Many of you know Robert Massey, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. He won that prize for his biography of Peter the Great. Now he turns to Catherine, who is the wife of the grandson of Peter the Great. She, Catherine, does assume the throne and becomes the empress. But I'm getting ahead of this story because those early years, Robert Massey, for Catherine had to have been so bitterly lonely, and yet she used it to educate herself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She was lonely. She was, her husband was interested in his dogs, his soldiers. He was still a man child, and he was not interested in her. It may be that he felt threatened by her. It was pretty obvious that she was much more intelligent than he.
And yet she became that dutiful wife.
She tried very, very hard to act the role that she'd been brought to Russia to perform. But left alone for hours and days, and she began to read. And she read a great many things. She started with novels, as most young girls do, young women. But she eventually began to read the works of the philosophes of the Enlightenment, mostly French, but others. She had learned French as a child. And she read Voltaire, she read Diderot. She began actually with Montesquieu, who was talking about the basis of monarchical rule, of autocracy, of despotism, and how it could be adapted or administered with tolerance, and which would bring to the country of the ruler greater efficiency, greater, if you can say it, patriotism. And she absorbed all of this. And later, she succeeded. In some ways, she did not succeed.
How long did her mother-in-law, the Empress Elizabeth, rule after Catherine and Peter III were married?
Almost 20 years.
20 years.
Almost, yeah.
And then did she die?
She died on what we would say Christmas Day, December 25th, in 1761. Peter, Catherine's husband, came to the throne and lasted only 6 months.
How come?
Because he was arrogant, incompetent, and tried to force through some of his ideas against the not only the wishes but the power of the Russian Orthodox Church, of the Russian army, of the people of St. Petersburg. And they began by acknowledging that he was the new Tsar or Emperor, but only 6 months passed before Peter suddenly, the ultimate straw was when he declared war on Denmark, which had no relation to anything significant to Russia, because of a personal whim. And the guards regiments, the army, just said no.
How did Catherine seize the throne?
She was supported by the guards regiments. By then, she had a lover, Gregory Orlov, who was one of five brothers, all guards officers. They were all circulating in the barracks, in the regimental barracks, Catherine's their preference and the advantages of that. Of a rule by Catherine would be. And they didn't want to march off from northern Russia to Denmark. So one day, after Peter had publicly insulted Catherine in front of hundreds of people at a diplomatic
banquet.
How
did he insult her?
He stood up because she hadn't stood up when he had called for a salute to Frederick the Great, Russia's then enemy, whom he greatly admired. And he shouted down the tables of the banquet, Durak, fool, or idiot.
Whoa.
And she wept. And he'd already made convincing signs that he wanted to divorce her, which in Russia, in Orthodox religion, means achieved by putting her in a convent. This was not what she wanted to do with the rest of her life. She had many supporters. And when he was at a suburban palace outside St. Petersburg, she came back, rallied with the help of these officers, the guards regiments, and then led a march of 14,000 men, on Peter's sort of palace and encampment. And there was no resistance. He gave up very, very quickly and abdicated. Frederick the Great said he behaved like a child being sent to bed. He abdicated. He swore allegiance to her. She sent him off to detention in a country house. And there, a week later, he died in mysterious circumstances.
Do we have any indication that she played a part in his death?
Believe me, historians for 200 and some years have explored that. It was convenient for her. There's no evidence that she initiated it or authorized it. After the fact, since these were the same men who had supported her coup, she did not punish them. But she learned when the leader of the guards wrote to her and said, "Matushka, little mother, he is dead. We ourselves know not what we did." And for the rest of her reign, most Russians were absolutely delighted. But she cared a great deal about European opinion. And for the rest of her reign, she hoped and did what she could to convince people that she was not responsible.
Now, wasn't there another claim to the throne after Peter III abdicated?
There was. There was a man. He had been elevated to the throne at the age of 3 months, and he'd come to the throne before the Empress Elizabeth, Peter's daughter, took the throne. And she had dethroned him, put his family into sort of domestic exile. And then when he was still a boy, she locked him up in a fortress up the river, and he was there for 20 years.
This is Ivan the Sixth.
Ivan the Sixth, yeah.
You know, it's fascinating when you hear these stories and you think about today's politics. I mean, it was life or death back then, or life or lifetime imprisonment back then. Just absolutely fascinating. So tell us about Catherine's rule.
Just to go back, the explanatory factor is the stakes were very high. And if you had a consecrated crown, well, he wasn't crowned, but a consecrated tsar roaming around, not on the throne, he would become the focus for all sorts of, if there were, as there always are in any situation, opposition.
Nefarious plots.
Absolutely. Anyway, Catherine's rule. When she came to the throne, she was determined to bring into her decisions and policymaking Enlightenment principles. And at first, she succeeded. She decided, for example, that the whole Russian law code was out of date, contradictory, tangled. For one thing, Peter the Great had dictated law from the saddle. Who knew what had been written down? He was so powerful and masterful that nobody ever argued with him. She wrote first an introduction using Montesquieu. She said, "I plagiarized him disgracefully. I hope he'll forgive me. I meant the best for my people." This was intended as an instruction for a legislative commission she was calling. It was an assembly, the first of all the classes of free Russian citizens, not the serfs. We can talk about that if you want, but everybody else, the nobility, the government officials, merchants, townspeople, and so forth. And she said, "I want you to come and tell me what needs to be changed, and then you advise me on how to change it." They fell to arguing between themselves, between classes, and so forth. She, at that point, wanted to do something to either eliminate serfdom or ameliorate it. The nobility, who were the landowners, who owned the serfs. And, Diana, it's important to realize that wealth in Russia was counted in the number of serfs, not in land. And the nobility said, we need serfs to work the land. And if they're taken away from us, who's going to pay us? Yes. And what are we going to do? And also, what are the serfs going to do? They're not going to have any land. And on these sort of practical and very forceful objections and opposition, that fell. Then she got involved in various difficulties with neighboring countries, primarily through her reign, the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, which controlled the whole of the Black Sea coast. Peter had taken the Baltic back from Sweden. He'd failed in the south. Catherine was determined to succeed, and the Turks were well aware of this. They attacked Russia twice during her reign. She won both wars, but they were difficult. They absorbed, as wars will, taxes, casualties, etc. She fought those wars to a conclusion which was not satisfactory to everyone. During her reign, Poland, which was a large, sprawling, amorphous, poorly governed country, was partitioned three times between Poland's powerful neighbors, Russia, Prussia, and Austria. And in those partitions, Poland disappeared for over a century.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One question before we open the phones. She did establish supremacy of the state over the Russian Orthodox Church. How did she do that?
Well, Peter had done away with the patriarch, sort of the pope, in his reign, but it was still very powerful. Various monasteries and church regions owned serfs, some thousands of serfs. Catherine decided that the great wealth of the church really should be devoted to something useful to society and the citizens. And the church had actually supported her coup, but then she turned and passed legislation, or decreed legislation, that the church should give up these lands. And all of the leaders of the church agreed to do so, not always willingly, except one who objected fiercely and condemned her and so forth. That's too long a story to tell now. But she was looking out for the future of Russia and its citizens. As you know, she created the greatest art collection in the world. She established medical schools, training academies for young women. She was the first person in Russia to be be inoculated for smallpox. And everybody, a list a mile long.
Isn't that wonderful? I have a caller here from Jacksonville, Florida, who'd like to talk about that interest in art. Good morning, DeBry. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is a great honor for me. I was wondering if Mr. Massey could talk a little bit about Catherine's legacy in terms of the visual arts, or I mean the applied arts. Specifically, the legacy we've lost a lot to do with her son, Paul I, and also the Second World War, specifically her glass bedroom, which is cutting edge. It was cutting edge at the time at Zasconcello, her palace at Pala. Also, the palace we also have in Moscow, the Catherine Palace, which is currently occupied.
DeBry, I'm afraid you're asking a great many questions. But what about her interest in the arts?
She was a great collector, and she became, as the paintings she bought arrived in St. Petersburg, quite knowledgeable about arts and artists and so forth. And she used the gigantic Winter Palace as a a museum. She built another smaller palace so she could hang her favorite pictures there.
Was there a glass bedroom?
Well, yes. But she was the founder, and her collection was the basis of the great, one of the great art museums and collections in the world today, at the Hermitage. Now, as to the other questions, I'm afraid I wasn't writing them down. Do you want to repeat?
And I'm afraid we're out of time for this particular segment. And I think what you should do, DeBry, is to read this book. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. From MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the early history of the birth control movement with Jill Lepore. She says it's easy to think the politics surrounding the issue have always been the same as now, but
the arguments made by one side or the other have kind of switched sides over time more than once.
Lepore writes about the history of Planned Parenthood in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
Welcome back. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Massey is with me. His new biography is titled Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. She was, of course, the Empress of Russia and served for 3 decades. Let's go to Mishawaka, Indiana. Good morning, Matt. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Mr. Massey. I am a big fan of several of your books.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, I know that that Catherine's predecessor, Elizabeth, was very anti-Prussian and loathed Frederick the Great, and I know her husband was a big fan. What exactly was Catherine's relationship with Frederick?
That's an interesting question. Catherine was German. Her father had been one of Frederick's officers. Her father actually did not want her to go to Russia because of he was a devout Lutheran and he knew she'd be forced to convert. But Frederick wanted her to go because of the connection and the link. The link would be helpful to Prussia's foreign policy, and so he endorsed her going. And Elizabeth, as the sort of diplomatic situation developed and worsened, and Russia was then allied with Austria, Elizabeth fought Russia during the Seven Years' War, which we know here as the French and Indian War. We were a sideshow, but became important. Frederick and Elizabeth fought till Elizabeth's death. Elizabeth once assured the Austrian ambassador that I will sell half my jewels. I will not give up this war, no matter what. And during the war, Russia and Austria drove Frederick and Prussia almost to destruction. The Cossacks rode through Berlin and so forth. Meanwhile, as you know, and as Diane has told us, she brought Elizabeth brought Peter from North Germany. He was a passionate admirer of Frederick's, the greatest soldier of the age. He did not want to go to Russia. In fact, he hated Russia. He admired Germany. He wanted to go home. He would have preferred to be the Duke of Holstein-Gottorp, which he, in fact, was, to being Emperor of Russia. And all during his life as the heir to the throne, he was explicit about this, so that his relationship with Elizabeth was difficult, to say the least. Catherine took the exact opposite tack. She wanted to be Russian. She learned the Russian language, which he basically refused to do. She became Orthodox, enthusiastically, at least on the surface. And she devoted herself through the rest of her life to Russia. So that was another difficult disagreement between Catherine and her husband.
All right, to Millfield, Ohio. Good morning, Tom.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for inviting me on. My question is about two characters, and I'm not sure whether Stepan Razin coincided with Catherine's rule, but I believe Pugachev did, and I wonder if you could talk about those two individuals and their rebellion against Catherine.
Well, Stepan Razin was quite some time before Catherine. He did rebel, and he was a hero to the Cossacks and people living in the what was the south of Russia, is now Ukraine. Pugachev was certainly a factor in Catherine's reign. 10 or 11 years after she came to the throne, when the Russian army was wholly engaged against the Turks, he deserted from the army and wandered across the south of Russia to the Volga regions and near the Urals, and decided that he would try to become somebody he wasn't. He announced that he was Peter III, returned, Catherine's long-dead husband, returned, and he'd come to throw his wife, who had connived at removing him, off the throne, and bring back, in various manifestos, he said he would bring back the true freedom of the Russian people, by which he meant going back to really pre-Peter the Great, to the old Russia of the old believers, the very conservative Orthodox believers, and establish himself as a true Tsar.
Thanks for calling, Tom. You know, as you talk about Catherine's relationship with the Orthodox Church, she did believe that the great wealth that the Church held really should be used for the betterment of the public. I don't know how much success she had in that realm.
Great success. In fact, this is an area in which she succeeded almost better than Peter. Of course, she came along 37 years after Peter's death. Things had continued. The Orthodox Church was very, very wealthy. And she said, from now on, the Church and its its priests and bishops and so forth are going to be servants of the state, in fact, employees of the state. We will pay their... She didn't do away with the religion. She put it on a different secular basis. And it continued and on basis until the revolution in the 20th century.
Let's take a call here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Theo.
Hi, Diane. Our ancestor was the son of Catherine and Gregory Orloff. He was sent to an estate. I just wondered if Mr. Massey had any comments about him and that relationship.
Well, you must mean Bobrinsky.
Yes.
Yes. Orloff had been Catherine's sort of permanent lover, favorite was the title he used, for 12 years. And they had a child who was Bobrinsky. He was illegitimate and could not be recognized as a potential heir to the throne. But she saw that he was brought up, educated. When he became a man, he was given money. He traveled. He lived in Paris for a while. She kept an eye out or had her sort of ambassador and agents in Paris. He was a good man, and interestingly, when Catherine died, her legitimate son, Paul, who became the Emperor Paul I, brought his half-brother back and made him a count, and they became part of the Russian nobility, and there you know the rest.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. How did she die? Apparently there are a great many rumors out there.
There are some...
pretty salacious.
There are some salacious and quite impossible rumors, which were originally generated by her enemies, by her foreign enemies, particularly in Paris, in France, and in Turkey. Catherine actually died one morning. She had been, she was 67. She had been at a party the night before where she had laughed hysterically and had to go to bed because she was, her face was getting red and so forth. So she went to bed. She got up, as always, the next morning at 6 to start doing her work, reading her correspondence, and so forth. And at 9, she told her her manservant and ladies-in-waiting, excuse me a minute. And she withdrew into the inner part of her apartment, and she didn't come back. And eventually the her leading manservant went in, and she wasn't to be seen. And so he went to the bathroom, and the door was blocked. And he called for help, and she was lying on the floor in the bathroom, unable to speak, her face almost purple. She'd suffered a stroke. They called for more help and got her on a mattress, which they slid into the bedroom. And she was in that condition of living but dying for more than 30 hours.
Oh my.
Paul came, and everybody was gathered around her. The important thing, Diane, was whether she was going to revoke Paul's succession to the throne, which the emperor, the sovereign, could do until the moment of death, and she did not.
What was her stature physically?
She was not tall, but she gave the appearance to everybody. There are many comments by foreign ambassadors or descriptions who were writing home, because when she came to the throne, everybody wanted to know who, what, how, what she looked like. She was described as achieving height through her great dignity, the carriage of her head. She had head of thick auburn hair. She had very bright dark blue eyes. She had a prominent chin. She carried, people commented on her hands and her neck as being exceptionally beautiful. But really the thing that about her persona was her character more than her appearance. She was the empress. Nobody ever doubted it. And that, having displayed that, she could be funny. She could be witty. She could encourage people to be informal. By the people who knew her in her circle, she was greatly loved.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Roy.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Mr. Massey.
Good morning.
In 1976, I had a summer session and I needed a class, and I ended up in a special bicentennial session with Nikolai Nikolaevich Bokovitinov, who got to come for the summer and teach his seminar on the American Revolution. Can you speak about Catherine and her relationships, her comments to George III, and not leasing him a 30,000-man Russian corps to suppress his colonists?
That's a very interesting point. Catherine was not in favor of revolutions. Her idea of reforming government, changing the administration of people, was to work from the top by educating, by looking for and finding educated rulers. Hopefully, she thought, in the concept of the Enlightenment, which he tried to do. So the American Revolution, which was distant, was not something she truly favored, although she was aware of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and those other people who were affected, influenced by the Enlightenment. Of course, the French Revolution was the thing which really terrified her because of the savagery of the as it progressed from Mirabeau to Robespierre. The interesting thing you brought up was the King George III's request, and it came directly from the king, monarch to monarch, for I think it was 20,000 Russian infantry and 1,000 Cossacks to be carried to America at British expense. Britain controlled the seas but didn't have a large army to deal with what the British Foreign Office described as the king's dissatisfied American colonists. Well, you know, having been turned down by Catherine, she said, I don't think so. He then went on and hired the Hessians, who made themselves well-known, perhaps infamous, in their behavior towards American towns and soldiers. But I, just to carry on one more thought, can you imagine what we would think today of the Russians? What might have happened if 20,000 Russian soldiers and 1,000 Cossacks had been loosed on the American colonies?
What do you think?
New York, Philadelphia, whatever. I think we would, you know, Russia is the one country or one of the countries with whom we have never fought a war. We had a Cold War, and it got pretty ominous for a while, but we've never fought a war. If the Russians, even as hirees of the King of England, had come here and done some of the things that they were capable of doing, that might have been enough to color our attitude.
Mr. Massey, you have written just a fascinating account of this woman, and I thank you for it.
Thank you very much.
Robert Massey, his newest book is titled Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.